This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Asia Pacific Currents.
News and labour issues from the Asia Pacific region.
We strongly condemn the police that arrest the protesters.
Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock.
On Community Radio 3CR.
Workers of the world should unite to fight this greedy capitalist.
Brought to you by Australia Asia Worker Link. Good morning and welcome to Asia Pacific Currents. It's 1 minute past 9 o'clock here on Community Radio 3CR. I'm Giselle Hannah.
And I'm Diana Beaumont.
And we'll be taking you through to 9:30 this morning. Asia Pacific Currents is brought to you by Australia Asia Worker Links. And if you want to get in touch with Australia Asia Worker Links, you can call us on 966 372 77. You can find us on the web or the www.aawl.org.au, or you can email us at aawl@aawl.org.au. And coming up on today's program, Diana.
We've got, as usual, a roundup of labour news and workers' struggles from the Asia Pacific region, followed by an interview with Afshin Nukusarash, who is with the campaign group based in Melbourne called Iran Solidarity. I spoke to him during the week about the state of organised labour and other progressive campaigns in Iran. So stay tuned for that interview about 9:15 this morning on Asia Pacific Currents. But now straight into the news. We start this morning in China, where strikes are continuing in auto suppliers after three successful strikes you might have heard of against Honda suppliers in the south of the country, which set a precedent for large wage increases, which it seems other workers are trying to achieve at their own plants. This week, another strike began at the Japanese-owned Atsumitec company in the southern city of China, called Foshan, the same city where two of the earlier strikes happened against Honda suppliers. Reuters reports that all of the plant's 200 workers have stopped work and are demanding a nearly 60% pay increase. This is significant because it's the fifth Honda supplier to strike since May, and it seems there's a copycat effect happening. At this latest striking plant, Atsumitec has enough inventory to last through until yesterday, meaning that the car assembly plant has likely run out of parts and there'll be pressure mounting, so hopefully the workers can achieve an outcome and get their pay increase. The strikes highlight how just-in-time manufacturing, which is now highly popular amongst Western and Japanese and the like manufacturers, can put companies at risk because of how little margin for error there is. And in China, until lately, they've been assuming that workers are not going to strike and cause any problems. So a lot of companies have kept very lean inventories in China, and a lot of them are coming unstuck as workers start waging industrial action. The official Chinese trade union is certainly not involved in leading this or any of the latest strikes, nor is there any indication that they've been supportive of workers' demands. In fact, at earlier strike sites, some union officials blatantly sided with management against Honda workers, and in one case even ended up in violent scuffles with Honda workers when union officials tried to force them back to work en masse. In response to the strike waves lately, minimum wages have been increased in more than 10 cities across many Chinese provinces, including Beijing and Shenzhen. And that's a big government reversal, it would seem, after minimum wages were frozen at the start of this year. Hopefully, with more strike actions, we'll see more increases in wages at the workplace level and at the government level.
Moving now to Bangladesh, for the last few weeks, Dhaka, the capital city of Bangladesh and its outskirts, have witnessed a rebellion by 100,000 garment workers. Bangladesh's 4 million garment workers constitute 40% of all industrial workers in the country. In the last year, the sector contributed 80% of the country's total exports. The protest started in Ashulia, an industrial suburb of Dhaka, on the 13th of June. The workers demanded an increase in the minimum wage that trade unions be allowed to organise in the factories. On the 21st of June, about 60,000 garment workers left the factories in Ashulia and occupied the trunk road that connects Dhaka and other parts of Bangladesh. Police used tear gas, rubber bullets, hot water cannons and baton charges against them. The elite Rapid Action Battalion Force, infamous for crossfire killings, also confronted workers. More than 100 were injured. The garment bosses responded to the rebellion by shutting almost 250 factories across Ashulia in a mass lockout. They thought that would disperse workers and allow them to dictate the level of the minimum wage. But their plan backfired as garment workers radicalised and were joined by other workers and supporters from neighbouring areas. Foreign retailers supplied by Bangladeshi garment factories panicked about shortages of supplies, and the garment bosses were compelled to reopen the factories on the 23rd of June. The backdrop of the workers' rebellion is the unprecedented hike in the price of food, rent and other essentials. In the last 10 years, the cost of living has increased by 94%, but workers' wages only increased by 24%. Garment workers' wages are among the lowest of all industrial workers in Bangladesh. Many are compelled to work 12-hour days, usually without overtime payments, contravening labour laws. Factories are also unsafe. In the last 10 years, there have been many incidents of workers who have been burnt to death in workplace fires. Workers' organisations have been demanding that the minimum wage be reset in line with the cost of living. In 2006, faced with a mass revolt, garment bosses agreed to a monthly salary of approximately 1,700 taka, which is about 30 Australian dollars. But this was not enough to meet living costs. One study found that a family of four living in Dhaka needs a minimum monthly income of over 8,000 taka, which is about 133 Australian dollars. Since 2006, a global recession and skyrocketing food prices have made workers' lives increasingly precarious. Workers' organisations demanded a monthly minimum wage of 6,200 taka, which is about 80 Australian dollars, but the bosses have offered only about 30 Australian dollars. This meagre offer provoked the current rebellion by garment workers. Foreign retailers are trying to shift the responsibility for garment workers' pay onto their local suppliers, but it's clear they benefit from low wages and low tax on their profits. A recent report in the Dhaka press revealed that H&M, the giant Swedish retailer, which has a long record of doing business in Bangladesh, paid just 50 pounds in local corporate tax in 2008, which is about 70 Australian dollars. The main opposition party, the Bangladesh Nationalist Party, enforced a day-long strike across the country on the 27th of June to protest against the government, but it didn't include the garment workers' demands for increases to the minimum wage in its charter of demands. Left-wing parties within the ruling Awami League-led coalition government, as well as opposition left-wing parties, supported the garment workers' demands and organised rallies.
That's just incredible, Giselle, listening particularly to the role of the foreign buyers in Bangladesh. If workers are paid 30 Australian dollars a month and these foreign buyers or the foreign investors who've set up are paying you 50 pounds a year or whatever it was in tax, can you just imagine the profits that they're extracting from that part of Asia?
Well, I mean, there's that. Here's the other thing, right, that and this is one of the things that's going to become clear across all of the stories that we talk about in the news today is that what this particular story talks about and also what your story talked about was against the backdrop of effectively the economic crisis, workers are on the move right across the world. I mean, that was the strike in China. This is the strike. And, you know, we can look at profits and we can compare it against how capitalists profit from the unpaid wages of workers in places like Bangladesh or China. But effectively, capitalism is in crisis right now, and not just in these parts of the world. The workers are on the move everywhere.
Yeah, there's only a certain level to which you can squeeze people before they erupt, and we're seeing 100,000 garment workers in Bangladesh, and that's the way that they're going to change things there. But we're, I suppose, running out of time on Asia-Pacific Currents, so let's get on to the next news item. We're going now to India, where production at a Nokia factory has also been hit by a strike, when workers are demanding higher pay. According to newspaper reports last week, the strike began on Tuesday after employees' talks with their managers failed. This IT facility near Chennai in South India caters to local and export markets and employs 8,000 people. And Nokia did not comment on the strike and the reported or the losses that they were making because of it, but said in a statement the company discussed a long-term wage settlement with the employees through their trade union on Monday. Nokia, the world's top cell phone maker, had said in April mobile handset production at the India plant had crossed 350 million handsets over its 4 years of operation. And now I'll go straight on to news of another labour strike in Turkey's fledgling IT sector, which was launched on Friday in the Aegean province of Izmir. The Sosyal İş labour union, affiliated to the Confederation of Progressive Trade Unions in Turkey, or DISK, has implemented a decision to strike at the Unibel company, which provides IT services to Izmir Metropolitan Municipality. As the collective bargaining process reached no result, a total of 37 employees started to strike on Friday. The president of the union said that the workers at Unibel are providing software, hardware and IT services to the municipality, and their salaries are way below the salaries of workers that are employed at other companies. Unibel workers receive 30 to 35% less money than those who work in other municipal companies. And to compensate for this, the union is demanding a 200 Turkish lira hike on an equal basis, but unfortunately that was not accepted and negotiations are going on. The company Unibel was founded in 1994.
So just to recap a couple of those things, right? So the garment workers across probably many, many different foreign companies, Nokia, Unibel and Honda, where there are operational factories across Asia, all of which are currently in dispute with workers for wage and health and safety claims. And then in New Zealand, workers angered by moves they see as rolling back their rights intend to protest outside the National Party conference in Auckland tomorrow, that Sunday. Prime Minister John Key is expected to announce at National's midterm conference in Auckland this weekend moves to widen the 90-day trial scheme under which workers can be fired without any comeback. He's also expected to announce moves to reduce union access to workplaces. Unfair dismissal changes are just the tip of the iceberg, said Helen Kelly, who is the president of the Council of Trade Unions in New Zealand. There's now an accumulation of attacks on workers either already implemented or in the pipeline. All workers starting a new job are now at risk of being fired at the whim of an employer. To make matters worse, we believe the government will also make it more difficult for the employment court to question the reason why any worker has been dismissed, Kelly continued on to say. Labour leader Phil Goff said it amounted to a fire-at-will attack on workers' rights, with his views echoed by Green Party co-leader Russell Norman. National allies the Maori Party expressed concern about the impact the 90-day trial would have on young Maori, making it even harder for them to find work during an employment crisis. Labour's ethnic affairs spokesman Ashraf Chaudhry said the restrictions would hit migrants hard as they already felt exclusions, discrimination and prejudice when they arrived. The 90-day trial and lack of union representation will make it worse. Union said the 90-day policy could lead to unsafe workplaces as new employees would be too afraid to raise concerns, but employers said it would offer them incentive to take a chance on an employee they might not otherwise have offered a job to. The 90-day scheme at present applies to employment in businesses with fewer than 20 people. The government had been looking at expanding to firms with 50 employees, but it appeared set to be extended to all companies regardless of size. Basically, work choices in New Zealand. And I think that's a conversation that we're going to continue to have as the issue intensifies in New Zealand. And we're hoping to bring you a more detailed interview about that next week on Asia Pacific Currents.
Yes, because I'm sure listeners know very well how disastrous the industrial relations reform that were brought in under our previous Conservative government were, and the extent to which the union movement had to mobilise to fight that at a legislative level and a workplace level. And I'm sure comrades in New Zealand are going to need similar solidarity. So watch this space, and we'll bring you an interview hopefully next week where you can get some more information about what kind of support you can offer. But that's it for our news roundup on Asia Pacific Currents this morning on your favourite community radio station, 3CR 855 AM. Stay tuned. After a quick community announcement, we're going to bring you an interview with Afshin Nukusarash about organised labour and left-wing movements in Iran.
From locking innocent people up in Baxter, detention centres, the Tampa crisis and the sinking of the CIVX, 3CR brings you the stories and the struggles of refugees and asylum seekers in Australia.
Even if asylum seekers make it to the mainland of Australia, they can still be removed from Australia, prevented from making an asylum claim and be taken to Nauru. We are effectively saying to the world at large, we will not receive asylum seekers.
Actually, we can't go back. That's why we are staying here without work rights, without Medicare. We are begging here for food and everything. That's why we are doing that. We can't go back.
Stay informed and support the struggle for refugee justice. 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM.
That's right, you're listening to Asia Pacific Currents on 3CR Community Radio. And right now we have for you an interview with Afshin Nukusarash from the Melbourne-based campaign group Iran Solidarity. Iran Solidarity has campaign objectives, including the release of political prisoners in Iran, the separation of religion and state in Iran, the abolition of the death penalty and all forms of torture, freedom of organisation, freedom for unions and freedom of speech, the rights of women, children, and ethnic and sexual minorities in Iran, and they're opposed to the proposed economic sanctions on Iran and opposed to war on Iran. I spoke to Afshin during the week about the state of organised labour in Iran and other progressive campaigns that are going on, and also asked him to reflect on the large popular mobilisation that took place last June following the contested national elections. In June last year, the world watched massive street demonstrations following the national elections in Iran, and it was mostly reported that protesters were contesting the victory of the incumbent president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and supporting the candidacy of the opposition leader, Mousavi. But I'd like to know, Afshin, what's your assessment, and what were the protesters' demands reflected accurately in the Australian media? Why were they on the streets in such large numbers?
The protest began obviously as a protest against the fraudulent election results. So I think there's definitely a truth to that they were a protest against the organised coup d'état. But as we saw, as the protest progressed and the demands that the people were bringing out on the streets, that you could see in the slogans that they were chanting and so forth, went beyond what the demands of the election campaign were.
For example.
We had people making general sort of attacks on the whole apparatus of the system. So on the the supreme leader, on the various religious institutions and the militia, and on issues about freedom of press, freedom of the issue of political prisoners and so forth. So as the movement went on and it became clear that the government wasn't actually going to grant any of the concessions or actually, properly investigate what had happened during the elections, I think people just sort of went right out and brought the whole regime under question.
And has the momentum continued from the protest last June?
The momentum, I think, did continue for the first 6-7 months, and it peaked around November last year, where we saw violent confrontations between protesters and the security force. Now, there's a series of errors that people made that momentum was lost. But I think the thing that's been most important in stemming the tide of this momentum has been the repression. Is just been really, really horrendous. Obviously, we've heard all the stories about the cases of rape and torture in the prisons, and outright shooting people on the streets and that sort of thing. And I think that's really what's had the impact on the movement. And there's just been no organisational orientation towards how to deal with that sort of repression. We haven't had people just being outright shot on the streets, in the last 30 years.
Yeah.
I don't think people were actually really prepared for that, and were prepared to deal effectively with that kind of situation.
And what was the role of workers and organised labour in the protests last year?
Actually, one of the criticisms that we usually hear is that the protests were made up of, northern suburban middle class youth, and that there were no working class people involved in it. Now, I don't necessarily believe this myself. I don't think that the kind of protest and to the scale that we saw could actually be sustained by just a sort of small section of the middle class, which is a really, really small section of society in Iran anyway. So there's definitely indications that there are people who are active and involved who would be more working class, and definitely elements of unemployed youth, which there is a lot of in Iran. But as far as organised labour goes, we've seen a lot of simultaneous strikes and a lot of organised labour activity during the same period. There's actually been a bit of an increase of it, but as far as organising protests goes or joining officially to support the movement in any tactical or strategic sort of way, none of that has really materialised in any significant way anyway.
And were there solid...
I think that partly has... Sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was just going to say that partly has to do with the orientation of the people who are actually organising the street protests. I mean, there isn't this orientation towards actually going out and appealing to organised labour to actually get involved and support the movement. But also, I think, again, that comes down to a lot of the repression as well. It makes it extremely difficult for people to go out and, have open debates or open, public meetings and that sort of thing to actually... involve a wider layer of activists. Mm.
And can you paint a picture of the organised labour movement right now in Iran? How strong is it, especially keeping in mind the targeted repression against union activists, and say in which industries is organised labour particularly strong in Iran?
Organised labour has had an upsurge in the last few years, but it is still obviously marginal. Again, coming back to the repression, has been really the thing that's kept the whole movement suppressed. We've seen, a lot of protests, a lot of strikes in various industries in the last 4 years, from everything from, manufacturing to teachers' strikes to, the bus drivers, which was one of the most significant ones, and the sugarcane workers. So across the industry, from service sector to the more traditional blue collar sectors, we've had a number of strikes, and they've just always been met with brutal state violence, and we've even had people killed, we've had people tortured, and union leaders routinely arrested, and we've had people imprisoned for a period of years, and one of the organisers of the bus drivers union is actually in prison right now, serving a 5-year sentence. So this is the kind of environment that they're, that they're trying to organise in. Things like their family members even being harassed and that sort of thing. Yeah. So it's extremely hard to actually get any coherent national movement. But what we do have is a lot of isolated, I suppose, incidents around the country where people are generally just responding to immediate demands, such as demanding their pay, in a lot of places, for example, payments haven't been made for a period of months in a row, and people literally have no choice but to actually go on strike and, you know, demand their pay in a lot of cases.
What is the state of the Iranian economy? Is that why wages aren't being paid, because the economic situation is poor?
Yeah, the economic situation has just been deteriorating, you know, for the last little while, to the point where I think state the official state rate of inflation is, I think, if I can remember correctly, somewhere around the 17-18% mark. Mm.
And unemployment?
Sorry?
And unemployment rates?
That's a very good question.
Is unemployment high?
It is definitely high, and I think, again, the official state record for people living under the line of poverty is somewhere around 22 million. Mm-hmm. So that's about like a third of the population. So that kind of gives you a bit of a picture of what the economic situation is like. But also, there's been a massive drive towards privatisation, which has also had an effect on labour relations. For example, in a lot of the cases where there's been payments that haven't been made, it's actually been owners, factory owners or bosses and so forth, who are actually, you know, saving money to buy state enterprise, you know, state assets and so forth that are being sold and auctioned to, you know, the highest bidder, and you know, they're not in a place to pay their workers because they're competing for getting their hands on the you know, the state-owned industries.
Yeah, that reminds me of an interesting question somebody asked at our Australia-Asia Worker Links public meeting on Iran recently when you were there. They asked, who are the established economic elite now in Iran?
The established economic elite would be, you know, a range of people from, I mean, obviously there's a lot of high-ranking clerics that own, you know, huge amounts of the production sector. And so, for example, you know, some of the richest people there are actually clerics. Mm. So, you know, that would be one section of it. The other section is, with all the current privatization and so forth, is actually the military wing of the regime, which is the Revolutionary Guards, for example. They're increasingly becoming, you know, the industries are becoming increasingly under their control and under their ownership. For example, the telecommunications actually, you know, mostly been now sold off to the military apparatus of the regime. And, you know, that kind of explains a lot of the brutal repression as well. You know, they actually have a lot. There's a lot in stake for them. You know, they don't want to easily let go of all this newly acquired wealth, you know. Things that were previously state-owned are now becoming, you know, increasingly controlled by few people in the Revolutionary Guard and so forth. And you know, they're increasingly playing an increasing role in the economic sector in the economic life of the country.
Mm-hmm. So, keeping all of this in mind, how would you assess the prospects for progressive left movements in Iran right now, and what are the priority campaign issues for the left in Iran?
Well, that's a really good question. To be realistic, I suppose, we have to say that the prospects are bleak. You know, I mean, if we're talking about the organised left, we're talking about like traditional parties like socialist or communist parties or anything of that kind, you know, the prospects would really be bleak, because, you know, as we know, these people were actually wiped out systematically after the revolution. And, you know, we've had executions of thousands and tens of thousands of people. So, you know, for example, a lot of these parties are operating now from outside of the country, but none of them have a whole lot of impact or influence on what happens inside. But, you know, there is definitely a whole lot of vibrant campaigns that are being run and organised by the battered civil society movement. So, you know, there's the women's campaign, which is being spearheaded by the 1 million signature campaign. you know, there is obviously the movement and the student campaign and so forth. And, you know, these have a lot of left-wing elements within them. It's just that, you know, the left is generally not, you know, that strong. There isn't this sort of open political space that they can operate in, that they can recruit people, or that they can even, you know, identify and propagate their ideas and so forth. So that really has an impact on the sort of outward appearance. A lot of these campaigns, and you know, the kind of things that they can say and how they can appeal to people, and that sort of thing.
Thanks so much, Afshin from Iran Solidarity, for joining us to discuss the situation of the organised labour movement and the left in Iran. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Afshin Nukusirash from the Melbourne-based campaign group Iran Solidarity, talking about organised labour and other social justice campaigns in Iran. And yes, you're listening to Asia Pacific Currents. I forgot to mention on 3CR Radio 855 AM. We're pretty much out of time, so just a quick announcement about a community event that's going on this evening at 7 PM at the Brunswick Town Hall. It's a solidarity fiesta in solidarity with Cuba, and it's $45 solidarity, $35 waged or $20 concession. That's 7 PM tonight at the Brunswick Town Hall on Sydney Road. But we are out of time. Thanks for joining us on Asia Pacific Currents. I'm Diana Beaumont.
I'm Giselle Hanna, and the Connollys are up next.